From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, overlooking dozens of golf courses that will never have us as members, this is the Golf Digest Podcast.
Welcome to the Golf Digest Podcast. This is Sam Wyman. The movie Sully has received rave reviews this fall for its depiction of U.S. Air Flight 1549, which Captain Chesley Sullenberger crash-landed in the Hudson River. There's actually a golf connection to that movie. There were six golfers from Chicopee, Mass., who were on a golf trip to Myrtle Beach for 4 days. That trip didn't happen. It was postponed until later in the year for obvious reasons. Anyway, one of the six golfers was Jeff Coloje, who, in addition to being an executive at American Express, was also a college golfer and plays to pretty close to a scratch still. Jeff is here to talk about the defining moment, or one of the defining moments of his life, and also the rare sensation of seeing his likeness and his character appear on the big screen, since he's one of the people who is depicted in the movie. Jeff, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, certainly glad to be here, and thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Well, let's start there, which is now this sort of title, for lack of a better word, follows you wherever you go, this amazing incident. So have you still gotten used to that?
You know, but it's certainly one that follows me. You know, wherever I meet people and they learn about the story, they're always curious as to kind of how the whole situation went down. So, yeah. Absolutely.
So I want to get to the full story in a second, but that is an interesting point, which is when you're meeting whomever, how far into you knowing someone does it take usually for them to know this part of you?
You know, personally, I try and keep it on the down low until I try to get to know someone, right? You kind of pick and choose your times when the story comes out, whether or not you bring it to their attention or whatnot. But, you know, I like to have at least a pretty solid friendship with someone before I make it known that I was on that plane.
Sure. Because we're talking about it where you can sort of joke about it, but it's this momentous traumatic event regardless, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think to a degree, you know, I've kind of came to the realization it is what it is at this point. Mm-hmm. From a traumatic standpoint, you know, I think about it often, but I got, you know, I've been trying to take the different view of it, you know, certainly view it as a positive thing. But it's changed the way I think about air travel, so. Absolutely.
I'm sure. So, all right, so let's back up for a second. You're on a golf trip. First of all, the rare six-person golf trip, which we should talk about as well, which is usually it's 8 or 12. So that's a whole separate thing. But six guys, all from your hometown, including your dad, your cousin. And tell me again, this was a trip that you usually take with this group of guys.
Yep, so for 7, 8, 9, 10 years, we've been going down to Myrtle. It was my dad, my cousin Jim, one of my best friends, Dave, my dad's friend from work, Rick, and then my cousin's brother-in-law, George. You know, we had planned the trip, as you mentioned, six. we couldn't get eight for various reasons, but some people had to back out of the trip. But, yeah, we've been doing it for 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. You know, it's kind of a trip we've all been looking forward to taking, so.
And the morning that you go, it's January 15th, so it's a long weekend, and on your way down, your plans were sort of thrown off course, correct?
Sure. I had booked the trip out of LaGuardia. They're all from the Massachusetts area, so I was living in Norwalk at the time, so I figured best to fly out of LaGuardia. They were on my way to pick me up and encountered a pretty bad snowstorm, so they were delayed in their travels. You know, I looked at our flights, and they were delayed and figured there was a chance they might get canceled. So, yeah, it was kind of a hectic morning.
Right. And your flight, the flight you were supposed to take basically was canceled, and you had to scramble to find a new way to get down. At one point, you talked about driving down.
Yep. So we were on Spirit Airlines at the time. That flight didn't get into LaGuardia. So, you know, I was actually talking with my wife. She was at work at the time, and we were just looking at different flights to get us anywhere south, right? I didn't really feel like taking the travel, so we found a flight into Charlotte. So I believe there was six tickets left on that flight. So we went over to the U.S. Airways counter, bought the last six tickets one way down to Charlotte. So
you get these six tickets, and the way you've described it is your initial feeling is relief. Like, okay, we don't have to deal with this anymore. We're on a flight. We're on our way to a golf trip.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, the first thing I did is I grabbed my cousin Jim. We went over, had a couple beers, and I remember looking at him saying, "Man, these are some of the best tasting beers I've had." Right? He kind of snarked at their remark that they were, you know, $10 to $12 beers. Right? But you know, we had a good laugh and just excited to get down there without having to drive 15 hours, even if it was 4 or 5 hours from Charlotte, if that. So a couple hours from Charlotte. So we were excited.
Okay, so fast forward to typical flight. At what point does it become something other than a typical flight?
Pretty much right in. The one memory I have is my wife at the time was 7 months pregnant with our first child. And I remember there was a gentleman with his daughter sitting behind me. And, you know, we were still on the runway. And she kept saying, "Daddy, are we in the air yet? Daddy, are we in the air yet?" And I just remember thinking to myself, man, it's going to be really cool to have a child, right? They're so kind of clueless as to what the world is, right? So it was really, God, it was only about a minute and a half into the flight where we heard just boom. And, you know, I remember looking out the window and just seeing this massive fireball just coming out the left engine, because I was in row 22A right on the window. And I thought to myself, man, there's no fire trucks or whatever coming to put this out. We're in a world of hurt, you know. So it was pretty real, real quick.
Yeah. And what was the reaction like from people around you?
Shock. You know, at first a lot of people didn't really realize the circumstance. I think the people that weren't on the window as well didn't have an idea as to the severity of what the engine looked like. It was in rough shape. You know, there was a lot of fire coming from the engine, and you know, there was no turbulence, right? So that's kind of one thing that freaks people out, but there was no turbulence. It just kind of came to a very eerie quiet because the engine stopped working, right? So normally when you're climbing, you hear the revving of the engines, and that totally went silent.
Okay. And so from there, you're obviously forced to consider that this thing might go down. So talk me through, if you can, that thought process as that is sort of standing in front of you.
Yeah, so I remember looking down, and as you're flying over the Bronx, you know, you realize there's really no place to land this aircraft, right? And I remember we did make a steep bank to the left, which kind of brought the fire a little closer to the fuselage of the plane, so that really became real at the time, right? And as we started to lose altitude, you could tell that something was certainly not in our favor, right? I remember I could see planes taking off from LaGuardia, but the skyline of Manhattan was getting lower and lower. And I had flown out of that area, that airport, you know, numerous times, a couple hundred times probably, throughout my career. And, you know, I realized there's really not a lot else there, right? So if we can't make it around these buildings, where are we going to be? So, you know, I think people that were familiar with the airport and where we were at, we're probably attuned to the fact that it was pretty serious.
What communication to that point had there been from the cockpit or from the crew?
Nothing. So, you know, we heard, I don't know whether you call it a bang or whatever it is, to the stewardesses. And I think they were probably alerted that something was dire, you know, so they started saying, brace, you know, fasten your seatbelts. And then a little while after that, they started saying, brace, you know, brace, heads down. And we kind of didn't really realize, you know, whether the plane had been taken over by somebody, whether it had been shot at. I mean, you just didn't really know. I mean, you don't really suspect birds and engines to blow up, right, kind of right from takeoff. So they were saying, you know, brace, heads down.
Right. And then you heard from the captain as well.
Yeah, we heard from the captain. So we cleared the George Washington Bridge, and you could tell he was lining up with the Hudson. And you can kind of tell the speed of the aircraft at that time, right? You know, when you're flying, normally you don't really realize how fast you're going. But as you're looking at the Hudson River and the West Side Highway, that's when Sully came on and he said, you know, just in like the most stern voice, just brace for impact. And it was so serious, and it kind of put you in your place to realize, you know, you probably don't have too much longer to live because you don't know whether you're impacting a building or whatnot. So.
So you've described this part for me before, which is when you do make impact with the water, you're sort of expecting the worst. But then you realize that your legs were cold and wet.
Yeah.
And that was, in a way, a good sign.
Yeah, I mean, not to get too graphic, but I mean, I looked at the seat in front of me and kind of was trying to time it with the water. And I thought, you know, the metal of the seat in front of me could potentially do some damage and impale my body and things along that nature. So, you know, you get a lot of thoughts rolling through your head, and, you know, I've explained it to my wife, which is pretty cool. I actually had like this like flash card of my life from, I was 31 at the time, just flashing through all the cool memories of my mother and my father and my sister, you know, everything, my marriage, just really cool things, you know? I remember just looking at that seat in front of me, and somewhat cowardly, I guess I said, make this painless, right? And I was trying to time myself with the water so I could take a deep breath. And, you know, I was looking out the window, and I remember just right up until we hit the water, I said, you know, just take a really deep breath and you might have a chance of swimming or whatnot. But right when the aircraft hit, I kind of, you know, you get shaken around pretty good. And I blacked out, probably shock or whatnot, right? And then, as you mentioned, I stood right up after the plane came to, and, you know, I was pretty deep in water already, but it was so cold. But, man, it felt so good. Yeah, it felt so good. It made me feel like I was alive, you know, which mm-hmm. obviously we were. And for a couple minutes, it was just relief. And then you realized, hey, this plane could sink, right? So you didn't really know your situation, but the cold water felt really good.
I'm sure. So crew shepherds you guys off to the wing of the plane. So first of all, what's that like when you're – and you, to be clear here, your group you were with, you were the only guy in the back of the plane, correct? Everyone else was up front?
So they were all in row 6 and 7.
Right. So you're shepherded onto the wing, and you reconnect with them or make eye contact with them. So what was that like?
Yeah, so I actually ended up making it out to the first – so the there was like a log jam on mm-hmm. the wings to get out the exit windows, right? And you could see the water through the windows, and you could see how dirty the Hudson was. And I actually ended up bypassing the wing, and I made it into the raft on the first class cabin on the right, and they actually had come backward, but we missed each other. So I didn't see anyone until literally we were rescued, and we kind of cut the raft away from the plane. I saw my cousin, I remember Jim, and he had this bright blue, I still remember vividly, he had a bright blue sweatshirt on at the time, and I was on the front of the raft, and the current that day was ripping, so as we cut the raft, we floated way away from the plane quickly, and I just remember my cousin sitting on the wing, and I put my arms up, I'm like, holy cow, man, like, did this really just happen? And he just put his arms up, and we were just kind of in shock, you know, so I didn't see them until later on in the evening. My dad ended up going over to the Jersey side, so I had no recollection whether or not my dad was in good shape, hurt, whatnot, because you know, it was just so chaotic. You had no idea whether people were injured. I remember looking back at the stewardess, and I saw her in some serious pain. Her leg was damaged pretty well, so you didn't really know. You mm-hmm. didn't have a flavor for whether or not people were hurt.
Just out of curiosity, this is such a trivial question, but did you have carry-on stuff, and did they just say leave it all? I mean, how did that all play out?
So I had carry-on stuff. I had my phone, my wallet, everything in the overhead. Uh-huh. I just left it. You know, you see some images of some people on the wing with, like, their carry-ons. They were saying just leave it, and it's like, you know, you almost want to poke blame, but in essence, you're just in a total state of shock.
Sure.
So you just kind of, you know, it's
It's hard to judge people for in that situation because you just, you know, unless you've been through it, it's hard to know what's going on.
Yeah, you know, you kind of laugh and say, what would this person think grabbing the luggage, right? But again, to your point, Sam, it's, you know, to pass negative judgment, it's almost like they're in shock.
So at what point, obviously, okay, so you've landed in the Hudson, you're alive. I would imagine even then, you know, this is kind of a big deal, but it became this international huge story based on the fact that everyone survived, that you landed in the Hudson. At what point did you sort of grasp the magnitude of it?
You know, I think when I got on the ferry and I borrowed a woman's phone, and she was commuting back, I guess, to New Jersey, and I'm like, can I have your phone? I need to call my wife, you know? And she's like, anything, whatever you need, you know what I mean? So you could tell the severity of it. And then I call my wife, I'm like, you'll never believe what just happened, you know? And I'm like, put on any news channel in the world and I guarantee it's on. Yeah.
So she had no clue until that point?
No clue at all.
Which is probably for the better at that point. And she's pregnant. She's how far along?
She was about 6 months pregnant at the time.
Right. And there's footage of you, I saw it, of you talking on a phone, presumably not yours since that was on the plane, sort of recounting what happened. That was, you were on with Brian Williams.
I was.
Right.
They had brought everyone to a certain pier. I guess they wanted to do a body count, right? And truthfully, I was more interested in finding my dad and my friends to make sure everyone was all right. So I kind of ran out of that pier, and I was just walking around. And there was so much media out there at the time, and they said, you know, were you on the plane? And I said, yeah, you know, I'm looking for my father. And then it was just mayhem. You know, one of the reporters said, Brian Williams is on the line. You know, he's got some questions, and he's just kind of in a state of shock, right? It was crazy.
And then from there, like, there was a ton of media attention. So we're talking about coming up on 8 years ago, correct, or 7 years ago, and all kinds of talk shows and things like that. When was the first time that you actually met Sully?
We did. We did something with Good Morning America, I believe. There were so many things, you know, it was crazy where he was there. So it was an honor to shake his hand, you know, certainly tell him how much him and First Officer Skiles, we were appreciative of what they did. So it was, I think it was either a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not even certain. I think it was about a couple weeks into it.
And, okay, so at that point, again, like, kind of the, obviously the reason that we're talking about this now is there's this movie coming out telling the story of the flight and kind of the aftermath. And at the time, you had no idea that some of this was being revisited about whether he had done the right thing. Yeah. What was your reaction when you heard that it was being looked at again and there was questions about whether he had done everything he could have done?
So when my initial reaction when I first saw the movie and saw how the NTSB kind of put him in a bad light, or I guess for all intents and purposes questioned his piloting, it was odd, you know. It was really odd, you know. I guess they need to look at it from all angles, right? It's probably a $75 or $80 million aircraft,
right?
So there's a lot on the line, right? Regardless of when I was halfway through the movie and didn't know the outcome, regardless, I didn't really care. You know, I cared for him as a person because, you know, you never wanted to see his 43 years of piloting being taken away if he had made the wrong decision. So it was odd the way they approached it. But it was pretty good at the end to know that he was found innocent of doing any wrongdoing,
right,
and ultimately he made the right decisions.
And
you know?
It's because at the time, I mean, there was no question in your mind.
No, he was a hero. And, you know, he is a hero. And, you know, that term's often thrown around kind of broadly. But, I mean, I think in a lot of people's minds, families and whatnot, he's a hero. He did the right thing.
It's worth noting, of course, you have six guys, all guys. And this is such a trivial thing as well.
Yeah.
All guys were bringing their golf clubs down, presumably. All that's gone, correct?
Yeah.
Now, did you tell me that they actually did recover a lot of the belongings?
So they recovered everything, which was crazy. A couple weeks later, we got a package from the NTSB. Everything was individually wrapped and itemized. I mean, down to a toothbrush, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty crazy. I mean, the sticks had a lot of rust on them.
Mm-hmm.
But we got everything back.
Do you still use anything that was in that bag?
So my putter's in my office as kind of a memento. You know, it's hanging in my office.
What kind of putter is it?
It's this Titleist Scotty Cameron.
Nice.
Rusted up one now. But,
that's amazing.
Newport 2 is what I used in college. So, yeah. It was nice to get the stuff back, you know.
So let's back up for a second. You did play college golf at Central Connecticut State, and as did your cousin Jim, correct?
Yep.
And he went on to stand as a pro as well. So, I mean, always been serious about the game. So this was, like, again, another I mean, obviously a fun golf trip, but you guys are serious players. I mean, how often did you play at that point in your life? That's 7 years ago.
I played a lot before kids.
Right.
I played whenever I could, you know, whenever I could. You know, it was a couple times a week. Now I'm lucky if it's once or twice a month, if sure. that. But, yeah, we played often. We played a lot of matches, and we had a lot of fun on the golf course. I mean.
And, again, you know, there's a million ways you can look at this about how this sort of shaped you, but one way is through golf, which is, like, your perspective towards golf at that point in your life versus now, a little bit also having to do with kids, but how has it changed?
I just want to go out and have fun when I play, you know? I always did. I actually think I'm a better player now because mm-hmm. it's just going out and having a couple beers, having fun, having some laughs. Still wanting to beat whoever I'm playing mm-hmm. with, truthfully, but it's made me more patient, you know? It's made me kind of just appreciate my time on the golf course.
Sure.
Not to sound cliche, but.
No, it's, I'm sure. And my understanding is after that, you guys had a connection to Titleist, or Titleist had reached out to you, correct? And you guys all went there for a day. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it was really cool. You know, from playing golf and being in the golf industry, you know, throughout college, I worked at some nice clubs. The Titleist reps, they knew my cousin Jim pretty well, and I knew the Titleist rep pretty well. They invited us down to the Titleist facility. They fitted us all up. They had some of their top teaching pros up there and club fitters, and they really hooked us up really well. New sticks from head to toe, shoes, bag. So it was a white gloves approach. It was a tour pro for a day, right?
Yeah. That's great. And then you guys went back. You ended up making the trip to Myrtle Beach. So talk me through that a little bit. What that was like. I realized there was some media, so it was kind of a big deal at the time.
Yeah, it was really cool. So the Golf Channel actually hooked us up pretty well. They called us. They sent down Todd Lewis. He played a couple rounds with us. They did some taping. I think it was Myrtle Beach Golf Holiday.
Mm-hmm.
Put together a package, and it was awesome, man. It was really awesome. We ended up driving. We took a van down, yeah. Which was fun.
Yeah,
it was a long ride.
To be serious though, did you drive because you were still leery of flying, or
a couple of the folks were?
Yeah.
So I think we all got together and made a group decision. Let's just make it easy on ourselves and our nerves, right? So we ended up grabbing a van and schlepping it down the 14, 15 hours.
How long before you got on a plane for real?
I had a business trip, I think just about 2 months after that. So it took some time, you know, and I was scared. I was really scared at the time. To get on the plane, I remember it was a flight out to Denver, and I was freaking out.
Right. So the other amazing thing about this whole story is that not only were you part of this, but now your life, or you're part of this event, is portrayed in a movie. So, and your character is on the screen for about 6 minutes or so. Talk to me a little bit about what it's like seeing that represented on the screen.
It's absolutely crazy. I mean. The first time I saw the movie, I went with just my wife, and we were just like, not laughing, but it was really odd. It was cool. I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah, the guy. The guy is, you know, he's a good looking guy, so at least it didn't make some.
I appreciate
slob,
that,
yeah.
Man. You know, that's I was happy with the portrayal. Yeah, it was super cool. You know, I got busted a little bit from some of my buddies. About the choice of clothing that he had on and things along that nature. I'm like, look, I had nothing to do with it, man. It was really cool. It was almost an out-of-body experience. You know, I looked at it more of, I wasn't even into the plot of the movie. I was just like, holy cow, man, this is really happening.
And then you told us, so you last time I talked to you, you said you've seen the movie 3 times.
Yeah.
Is that right? And then one time you went and your sister was in the bathroom and a bunch of women were talking. Tell that story because it's very funny.
Yeah, so the first time I went with my wife, and then I took my little boy, Gabe. He had recently just found out about the incident. He was starting to get questions at school, so I'm like, here's what happened.
How old is
he? He's 7.
Okay.
Yeah. And my other little boy, Miles, is 4.
Right.
My family, my entire family went to go see it. My sister came down from Jersey and whatnot. And then after the movie, there were some women talking in the bathroom about, you know, there were some people from Chicopee in this plane, and because it was a local theater, right? So she's like, well, actually, my brother's here. And they came out. This woman came running up to me like I was like Clint Eastwood or Tom Hanks himself. It was hilarious. She's like, can I have a hug? And, you know, it was just, it was nuts. It's pretty cool.
That's an amazing story. So, I mean, it's one of those things where I have to think that it's, like it or not, it's just part of your life now, part of who you are.
And it is, and I've come to the fact that it's pretty cool. You know, it's a great story. Sometimes it's a trump card to have, no pun intended, based upon the election. But it's something you can have in your back pocket to engage in conversation if you need it. Right? It's a cool story, and I think it's really cool because of the fact that outside of a few injuries, no one really was seriously hurt, right? If you think of the magnitude of what was happening, it's a cool story.
Sure. Awesome. Jeff Kolodziej, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much to Jeff Kolodziej for joining me on this week's Golf Digest podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and check back next week to see who our guest will be.